Take a network break. Pass around the virtual donuts as we analyze and think Fluence, the latest IT and tech news. We get stories today on Intel, Cisco, Ubiquity, and more. And I just have to say, I stole Think Fluence from you, Greg.
I've been trying to think of new ways to self-abuse myself about this so-called, you know, blogging, podcasting, and you know, Thinkfluencing is a word that I saw. I think I randomly saw it somewhere, or maybe somewhere on the Twitters or whatever. And it's just to remind you that this is not anything. It you keep your ego in check. So Thinkfluencer. That's me.
Right, here we go. And if you want to be a Thinkfluencer, this is a reminder for the new year. You can share your thoughts, your corrections, your feedback with us with a follow-up. That's at packetpushers.net/FU. If we accrue any significant number of those, we'll talk about them here on the network break. So packetpushers.net/FU.
Yeah, definitely important to give us your follow-up. What's right, what's wrong with the show, especially if we want to make, if we've made a mistake or if we've misunderstood something. Really important that we correct it in the next week's show so that people don't get the wrong idea. It is, we do try and work very hard not to make mistakes, but it's inevitable. And so do go to packetpushers.net/FU, please.
All right. We're sponsored today by Palo Alto Networks. Enable secure access from anywhere with Palo Alto Networks' cloud-delivered Tier 1 network, eliminating the complexity of using disjointed products. Their Prisma Access delivers comprehensive network security in a single services edge platform designed for all traffic, all applications, and all users. You can learn more at paloaltonetworks.com/secure-remote-workforces. And after the news, we have a Tech Bytes interview with NetBees. This is a sponsored show on monitoring a distributed wide area network and end user experience. Last but not least, if you like the network break, check out our other podcasts. We've got IPv6 Buzz, Full Stack Journey, Datanauts, Day2 Cloud, and of course, Heavy Networking. It's nerdy tech analysis and compelling conversations about infrastructure, cloud, professional development, and more. And you can go to packetpushers.net to hear them all. We've also got a YouTube channel if you want to see it.
Yeah, YouTube's kind of fun. Getting lots of people getting into YouTube, which is surprising to me sometimes, but there you go. People like YouTube.
Podcast on video. There it is.
There you go.
All right. To the news. Ubiquity, they make low-cost routers and Wi-Fi gear for home users and small and medium-sized companies. They're advising customers to change passwords and enable two-factor authentication after a breach at a third-party cloud provider may have exposed customer info.
This is not unsurprising. Ubiquity tends to occupy the lower end of the market, if I can say that. They've focused on a traditional business model of starting small with their low-end products, and they're steadily moving up into the enterprise space as they displace, you know, because they're a price point which fits small to medium businesses. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those companies don't need highly complex, highly featured,
right,
and expensive products. A lot of customers are opting to go down to something at a lower cost. But what people do want is software-defined networking, you know, using cloud-based services to get analytics and visibility as part of the package.
Yes.
And so Ubiquity's been offering those services, and that service has been breached in this case, which is concerning in the wider scope of things and bad for Ubiquity in the short term.
Right. And their public statement, I think, is doing its very best to sort of keep responsibility for the breach at arm's length. It's very much a kind of third person, this was a third party and we didn't have a lot to do with it. And we're not sure if anything happened and we're kind of sorry, but also, you know, go change your password.
That doesn't float for me, Drew. I don't know about
you. It
does
not float for me either.
Right. Blaming a third party. I mean, Ubiquity does have some problems as a company. Its corporate structure is a bit strange. The CEO is also the owner of the company. So he has a majority shareholding or some sort of substantial hold over the business in some way. And apparently is a very strong personality. So there are lots of questions around the Ubiquity business model. And when that sort of company starts to deny that it's their fault, that's a sign that something is wrong or something's not perfectly correct or that's not the right attitude to take. So I do have very substantial concerns about Ubiquity broadly. They do produce pretty good product. People rave about it. Yep. The features are there. The pricing is there. So it's a balance you've got to strike. But I think here, though, the sign is this is where security is out of your control. Whenever you buy this sort of cloud service from a third party, you know, even your preferred well-known branded vendor, you're shifting the security or responsibility for that security onto that vendor.
Right.
And this is a sign that these vendors are not well-equipped. You know, we've obviously had the SolarWinds breach a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. you know, just prior to Christmas, and the ramifications of that are still echoing around everywhere. But I was thinking, like, you know, Cisco's licensing service is publicly hosted. A lot of the artificial intelligence engines that we use are uploading data over the internet. What if those services get compromised? And I think this is a real concern. Now, hopefully the SolarWinds breach has encouraged these our brand vendors to go out and take securing these services more seriously, to take another look, to do a review, to conduct penetration testing. And you, as a customer, have a responsibility during purchase time to ask these questions and get guarantees. Because if they fail, you can then put them on the hook, right? Really important in the purchasing process that you say, are you taking adequate steps? And if they say yes, get it written down on a piece of paper. So if there's a breach, you can go and nail them and you can ask for a refund. That's really important. But that's my concern here. That's a sort of breach that you can't take responsibility for. There's nothing you can do to mitigate it. You have to depend on the third party. You know, and I was just thinking how horrendous it would be if somebody was able to breach Cisco's licensing system and then disable all of Cisco's licenses for customers around the world on their devices. And they'd be, you know, what would happen?
Yeah, just because you're using a third party, obviously you are hoping to offload some of the work and some of the risk, but it's still your customers. And at the end of the day, still your responsibility, your brand. So just because it's a third party doesn't let you off the hook. I think
They should have had a penetration testing on the third party. Right, enough to just go, oh, not my problem. You know, if you park your car in a friend's driveway and the car gets stolen, it's not the friend's driveway's problem.
Right. No, yes, there are lots of things they could do. Penetration tests are one. There's a lot, and there's also issues with penetration tests, but that's a different story. But yeah, just because you're offloading it to a third party, it's still your responsibility. It doesn't let you off the hook.
Yeah, and don't blame someone else. Right. That's just cowardly.
It is. And you'd think by this time vendors would know how to handle this, but I guess it's ubiquity's first time in the barrel. So
it's not like anybody cares, right? The SolarWinds thing, people's almost forgotten it. And yeah, the world's moved on and whatever.
I guess.
Just take it on the chin, go, very sorry, won't do it again. And no one's going to care in 2 weeks' time. So what?
Yeah. All right. Links in the show notes if you want to find out more. I guess the biggest news of this week is that VMware CEO Pat Gelsinger is going to take the top job at Intel, a move the new CEO calls a homecoming because he spent 30 years at Intel, rising to the rank of CTO before moving on to EMC and VMware, and now he is headed back.
Yeah, analysts are very confident that one person can turn around the company, which I think is inspirational. The idea that hiring just one person is actually going to fix up Intel's rather deep-seated problems seems to be misplaced to me. Is that just me?
No, I don't think it is misplaced at all. American business definitely has this cult of personality to it, that the CEO, the leadership is going to, you know, bring us to glory. And, you know, it can have some influence, but this is a giant company with really deep-seated technological and business problems. And so, yeah, Pat Gelsinger seems like a very sharp guy and very much beloved by people who've worked for him. So that's great. But one person is not going to be able to fix this.
No, I mean, Gelsinger did start at Intel as his first job. I think he said in a more personal note that he issued on Intel's website, links in the show notes, that he started Intel at 18 years old and spent 30 years there before he went over to VMware.
Yes.
And in a very real sense, Intel and VMware are complementary or very close partners. They don't compete with each other. Mm-hmm. And a lot of VMware's success has been built on features that came in the Intel x86 chip, you know, the hypervisor extensions, the virtualization extensions that were added to the silicon made VMware what it is today.
Right.
VMware likes to brag about its software, but really it all depends on the hardware. That's why SmartNICs and all that sort of stuff. So there is a balance here. And he calls it to come back home. It's like, really? You know, you're a grown-ass man. Don't call it home. It's a job.
That's also an American trait.
Yeah. Will be the greatest honor of my career. It's a job. Come on, relax. I do note, most of the analysts note that Intel is in a tough position. It's pretty interesting that a 9% spike in the share price is a bad rap for the guy who's leaving, Bob Swan.
A bit of a slap, yes.
And he was a financial officer. So they actually appointed a financial officer in the belief that doing more focus on the finances of the company would be better than a technologist, whereas Gelsinger is very much a technology person. Yeah. And so it's seen that this is a return to Intel being a technology company and less of a financial engineer. So that will be interesting. But of course, Intel's facing up to AMD is getting traction with some of its latest generation of CPUs. A lot of Intel's manufacturing plants aren't working. It's not able to make sufficient revenue from DRAM, which was a big part of its business in the past, and it's starting to lose market share in the DRAM part. And Apple has made a very high profile and a successful switch from x86 to its ARM CPUs in the desktop, which is obviously emboldening a lot of other people to say, why aren't we thinking about doing something? So, you know, there'll be money flowing into alternative desktop CPUs. So I do believe he's got his work cut out. I'm sure Intel's up to the challenge here. It's got a lot of portfolio, long established relationships, very strong market position. You know, we saw them recently buy Barefoot Networks. It's got a smart NIC division. It could just start making something out of that networking business and start competing more directly with switch manufacturer and really, you know, build a business. It's got lots of business units like that, could make a difference.
Yeah, we'll see. He definitely, as you said, you outlined some very significant challenges for Intel. The company has a lot of work to do ahead of it. So Mr. Gelsinger has his work cut out for him. For the VMware part, their executive ranks have been diminished. Last week, we were discussing how the company is suing its former COO. They also recently lost a GM for the cloud business unit who moved to Pure Storage, and then losing Pat Gelsinger, who is, you know, widely regarded as a very successful CEO. It, I think, puts VMware sort of on the back foot a little bit.
Well, there's been a fairly substantial drift from all the roles below that. If you watch Twitter and see who's, you know, job announcements and so forth, there's been a fairly substantial trend for executives and senior technologists to exit the company and look for other challenges. I think VMware might be going through a maturing phase where it stopped its innovation cycle, and it's now much more, it's acquired all the businesses that it wants. And a lot of those companies, like, you know, it bought Vela Cloud, and it acquired the Nasira, load balancing company,
Avi,
and a bunch of security companies, you know. There's a whole lot of energy coming in from those. And if you're an exec that's been at VMware for 5 years or 10 years running at a million miles an hour, it might be time to have like a little break and take those millions that you earned and do something useful with them.
Yeah, I do think Pat Gelsinger is leaving VMware in probably the best position it could, given that VMware is looking for its place in a cloud-first world. But he's also exiting in a time when it's possible that VMware's own star is going to begin to diminish. So he's stepping out well, I think.
Yeah, I think so. VMware's got a problem where before HPE and Cisco and Dell would sell its software for it, and it just sort of sat back and it was pretty much a done deal. And now we're seeing all of its partners exit, start to build up competitors around Kubernetes, and then of course VM management systems, and but in the guise of cloud orchestration. So instead of using VMware as an engine, they move to build their own VM platforms, a bit like what Nutanix has did, if you like, in a way. And so the path forward for VMware is not as dominant as it was, and I think it'll be interesting to see if they can, you know, as they've sprawled out, they're also putting themselves into competition with a lot more companies.
Right. Yeah, the hypervisor for a long time was the platform for the application, and that's just not true anymore. There are, I mean, the hypervisor is still relevant, but it's not where all the action and the energy and the development is.
We talk about the VMware tax is a fairly common term. So yeah.
Right. Yeah, and not everybody's paying that tax anymore. In any case, links to the show notes if you want to read more about that, but let's move on. The U.S. National Security Agency has issued suggestions for enterprises using DNS over HTTPS or DOT. The agency is recommending that enterprises using DOT do so using their own enterprise DNS resolver rather than a third-party resolver.
This makes perfect sense. If you're making DNS requests and they're happening outside the boundary, you've got no logging and you may actually be uncontrolled. And with corporate browsers quite often defaulting to third-party services on the open internet, there may be a certain amount of leakage and you may actually not have any control. So you should be blocking them at the firewall and doing it internally. However, DNS over HTTPS, this assumes that you're actually inside a boundary, right? That you can actually control the DNS servers. So we live in an era where everybody is working distributed at home from remote offices. They're not being connected to a campus. And how you would control people's access to DNS servers is not exactly specified in this document at all.
Right.
So I think the instruction here is well-intentioned but deficient, because what it doesn't address is the reality is that most people aren't inside the enterprise, you know, or not inside a traditional perimeter security method. Mm-hmm. And there is also a significant number of people out there still banging on about DNS over HTTPS isn't the answer. But, you know, I think this is also a sign that that boat has sailed and it is.
Yeah, I guess so. My impression was that DNS over HTTPS was always more of a consumer privacy play anyway, rather than an enterprise security play when you've got other options in the enterprise. So I'm also just curious why the NSA felt compelled to release this memo. I'm always suspicious of that agency, so I wonder what else
is going
on. Well,
I think this is sort of a reaction by the US government to trying to crank up the cyber security thing. Like before there was DNS over HTTPS, it was just unencrypted. anybody could read it off the wire with a standard packet sniffer. And you could also intercept it and, you know, do all sorts of things, basically take over it, as right. long as you could get physically between the request and between the client and the server. And, you know, lots of things used to use it, like the authentication gateways on wireless relied on DNS to intercept you and send you to a login page, for example. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that doesn't work anymore with DNS over HTTPS. So DNS over HTTPS is a technology that solves what's possible. I can encrypt the hop between the client and the server.
Yep.
What it doesn't solve is what happens on the server. Where's the data going? Where's the metadata? And it doesn't validate that the DNS lookup that you're doing is actually correct. So how do you know that the domain answer you get is actually certified or signed? How do you know if you get a response to packetpushers.net, is that the genuine packetpushers.net domain? We don't know.
Right, exactly. So, which is where something like DNSSEC is supposed to come in.
Yeah, but the flip side is that DNSSEC has been standardized for a decade, 10 years. We talked about this last week or the week before?
Last week, yep.
Yep. And, you know, last week the ISOC announced that DNSSEC had reached all domains. So now, really, so 10 years before it's actually in a point where the infrastructure is ready to support DNSSEC, that's, you know, so yes, DNSSEC lets you, you know, sign your domains and validate that you are the authorized holder of that domain name. But 10 years just to get to this point, that's not the way it works. That's, you know, and we now have a thing called Oblivious DNS, which solves the DNS server security. DNSSEC will still be needed to validate that you own the domain that you got the response for, but that's going to take another 10 years because ISOC seems to be just wasting everybody's time.
You mean ICANN?
Yeah, ICANN, ISOC, the whole group. The whole organization lacks a sense of urgency. Yeah. As I said last week, they sort of go like, ah, here it is. You think that's good? It's a bit like an open source project. You know, I said the same thing about the DENT open source project, you know, NOS. Yep. Mm-hmm. It was given to the Linux Foundation. Okay, great. Just because you put it there, does that drive adoption and acceptance? Is it, you know, do people really going to run off and find it and start using it? I don't know. Right. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, there's a link in the show notes, including a PDF of the recommendations from the NSA if you want to check it out. We're going
to
pause.
Well, if you want to put it, here's a good way to give it something to your boss and say, well, the NSA says I should.
There you go.
That's how you get budget, right?
There you go. Whatever you can do to get budget.
That's right.
All right, a brief break to tell you about our sponsor, Palo Alto Networks. In recent months, businesses have faced an unprecedented change to their workforces. Seemingly overnight, multitudes of employees once confined to their corporate campuses are now working remotely. That meant networking and security infrastructures were now required to not only make corporate resources available 24/7, but also deliver an optimal user experience. It's clear that the way we work has changed for good. 76% of global workers want the option to continue working remotely for at least part of the time. But moving to a predominantly remote workforce puts strains on existing infrastructure, and many organizations are grappling with the limitations of their current architectures. Palo Alto Networks wants to help you scale your remote workforce without compromise. You can enable secure access from anywhere with their Palo Alto Networks cloud-delivered Tier 1 network, eliminating the complexity of using disjointed products. Prisma Access delivers comprehensive network security in single services edge platform designed for all traffic, all applications, and all users. You can learn more at paloaltonetworks.com/secure-remote-workforces. That's paloaltonetworks.com/secure-remote/workforces. All right, back to the news. Cisco Systems and Acacia have renegotiated a long-delayed acquisition deal from $2.6 billion to $4.5 billion. Cisco originally announced the Acacia Communications acquisition in July of 2019, but ran into regulatory hurdles, and then in early January 2021, Acacia said it was going to terminate the deal, prompting a lawsuit from Cisco, and the two companies have now renegotiated the higher acquisition price.
So an extra $1.9 billion in 18 months?
Yeah.
That's a good deal.
That's a tidy right? sum. That is a very tidy sum.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got to think that Acacia was looking at the way the market was changing and its share price was being suppressed because its exit to Cisco was seen as generally bad for Acacia, but good for Cisco. Mm-hmm. And when Acacia announced that the Chinese government had delayed a decision yet again, it decided to walk away from the contract because there was clauses in the contract that had expired, which then triggered a round of negotiations. Cisco's agreed. Obviously, the US market has changed a lot in the intervening timeframe. It's continued to ramp up. Let's not comment about whether it's practical or not. And Acacia's share price shot up, I think, 10 to 20%, fluctuated between 10 to 20% more as soon as they announced they were walking away from the deal. And now Cisco's come back with a massively large counteroffer and the deal is back on as they wait for the Chinese government to approve it. There is not a lot of guarantees that the Chinese government will approve it. Acacia Communications has been a substantial supplier of optical components to the Chinese technology companies, and they don't want to see that go. So they may use this as a reason to negotiate continued supply agreements. That is, find a way for Acacia to continue to supply the components, even if the U.S. government is going to apply trade sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Well, Acacia is already an American company. It's based in Massachusetts. So I think, but having it be in Cisco's pocket, with Cisco being a massive competitor of Huawei, I could see why the Chinese would want to make sure some deals are in place to make sure they still get access to materials and products. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, if you're the Chinese government and you want to make sure that your local companies continue to have access to whatever they need, then, you know, you play politics with that sort of a deal. That's how everybody does it. That's what the US government does, the UK government, the EU government. It's all done the same way. Yep. Of course, Cisco wants to get a hold of Acacia. It wants to get a hold of the components that it makes to bring them into its supply chain, particularly the 400 gig and 800 gig components. So Acacia is one of the bigger makers of optical DWDM gear, as well as traditional Ethernet. So 400 gig, 800 gig Ethernet, they make the data pumps that actually handle those interfaces. And I think we've seen Cisco sort of go back to this model of being a soup to nuts buildup, where they actually own all of the technologies in their stack. One of the things we saw John Chambers do in years gone by is outsource everything, get rid of the stuff that's not core. And basically Cisco was a sales organization for a long period of time, and all of its warehousing was third party, and all of its manufacturing and design was third party. All its testing and software development was outsourced as far as possible. I think Chuck Robbins is flipping the other way. And I think it would seem that Apple has shown that if you have a fully integrated product cycle, you can get a lot more competitive. You can do a tighter, faster product cycle, innovation cycle. Uh-huh. The question of whether Cisco can be Apple is a little bit hard to believe. Cisco doesn't have a heritage of operating at speed, of being a unified organization. I'm sure they'll get there, you know, that there'll be some advantages, but it's, you know, can Cisco transform itself to reach that level of quality of insights into what customers really want, not what Cisco wants, and then the leadership of, you know, driving through certain projects to success like Apple does. That's something to be seen.
Yeah, well, clearly they see it as strategic because they're willing to splash out like a tenth of their annual revenue on it, including going back to the negotiating table to ramp up the deal. So, yeah.
Mm.
All right. Again, links in the show notes if you want to read up on it yourself. The U.S. wireless carrier T-Mobile has signed 5-year multi-billion dollar deals with Ericsson and Nokia to provide 5G RAN equipment, software, and services. There's no details on exactly how much T-Mobile is going to spend with each company, but all three companies are touting the deal.
Yeah, there's not a lot of information about this at all, except probably the only thing that I can drive out of this is that Nokia and Ericsson are splitting the deal or have partnered, which is unusual. Although sometimes the way that the telcos in the US go is they give this region to that vendor and this region to that vendor, and that's how they get supplier competitiveness.
Uh-huh.
They, you know, you get San Francisco, you get New York, you get Boston, you get whatever, uh-huh. you know, uh-huh. Uh-huh. whatever they are. So maybe it's doing something like that, you know, multiple suppliers. But probably more interesting is it's not Samsung, because, of course, we saw Samsung win the Verizon deal for $15 billion from memory or something, some stupidly large number.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. Mm. Yeah, so definitely something for Ericsson and Nokia to crow about. And I think smart of T-Mobile to want to have those competitors facing off with each other in this deal as well.
Yeah. So, and also we're seeing the, you know, these contracts as they settle out means the market starts to stabilize. Once you've got the master suppliers, you'll see who's going to win the networking deal. So, you know, will Juniper supply the routers to Ericsson and Nokia, or will Nokia use its own? That's the shakeup that now starts to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, further down the supply chain. That's right. All right, moving on. Some automakers are halting factory production due to a shortage of semiconductor chips. This is according to a story in Reuters and other outlets. In the United States, Ford and Toyota in particular have halted production at some factories because they just can't get semiconductors. And a modern car can have more than 100 chips in it. They're used for things like operating the engines, transmissions, as well as for touchscreen onboard entertainment systems and so on. Part of the problem is there's been an increased demand for laptops, tablets, gaming systems, gaming consoles, and an unexpected rebound in auto sales. Car manufacturers hadn't anticipated The demand for cars bouncing back like it did. And so they had reduced chipmaker orders and now they are paying the price.
Yeah. And this isn't just the US market. This is also Germany and the UK, which are two big car manufacturing places in Europe. I didn't find any articles about France, but presumably the same thing. A lot of them are idling up plants or taking production lines into maintenance because they don't have enough components in a specific piece. Mm-hmm. Not 100% sure, but my understanding is that the silicon that goes into cars is not the current, is not the same as what goes into tablets, smartphones, and computers. They use very small, you know, like 7 nanometer, 10 nanometer, 15 nanometer, 20 nanometer. And the stuff that goes into switches, for example, is 20 nanometer generally. But the cars are often using older plants, so 120 nanometer type stuff. They don't need to have these extremely low powered, super fast, super modern, high density chips. These are much slower. The clock rates are lower and they can use older plants. And a lot of those plants are actually in China. And what China does is goes and buys the gear that TSMC or other vendors decommission and then go and set up the manufacturing plants in China. But running those older plants is not the same. It's a more complex operation. And sometimes you don't want to put too many of them in because who knows how many sales. So there's not a lot of excess capacity of old silicon. And so there's these supply chain problems are quite unique, I think, to this whole industry.
Yeah, it was kind of fascinating when I first came across this story to think about just how so many industries are reliant on the semiconductor industry and how quickly we can run out.
Yeah. Well, most manufacturing is done in TSMC in Taiwan, but a lot of the other manufacturing is done in China, most of the places. Intel, of course, has a big set of plants, but it's only focused on the modern stuff. Finding a factory that wants to make something, say, that's using 10-year-old silicon chip manufacturing, you know, using the older equipment, that's not necessarily something that may be done in the places where it used to be. And then you shut down those plants, somebody comes along and buys them and maybe sets them back up somewhere else in the hope of attacking the tail of that market. And then there's not a lot of it. And then all of a sudden, if you want it, And keep in mind too, that cars also work on this just-in-time model. The assumption is that there's people out there,
right?
You know, they were a real pioneer of that. May not, yeah.
Yeah, it bit them this time. It absolutely bit them this time, yeah.
They mean that need to decide how to take control of their supply chain a little bit better. But, yeah, you know, so they'll get over it.
It'll be fine.
It'll be fine.
Yes, it'll be fine. You can always buy a used car.
Exactly.
All right, well, that does it for our news portion of the show. Stay tuned for a Tech Bytes conversation with sponsor NetBees on monitoring WAN performance and the end user experience. That's coming right up. You're listening to the Tech Bytes podcast from the Packet Pushers, a 15-minute podcast at the intersection of technology and business. We're sponsored today by NetBees, which provides network monitoring for the WAN, Wi-Fi, remote workers, and the cloud. Our guests are Panos Vouzis, NetBees co-founder, and Brad Addington, network engineer at the Amwins Group and a NetBees customer. Panos and Brad, welcome to the podcast. Brad, we're going to get to how you're using NetBees to monitor a large distributed WAN, but let's start with Panos. Panos, can you give us a quick overview of NetBees and what it monitors?
Great. Yeah, so NetBees is a solution for network engineers that gives you visibility of the end user experience in a distributed fashion. We use sensors to capture user experience with Wi-Fi, wired network. And actually, after the whole lockdown, we just released our work-from-home end-user agent that can be installed on the Mac and Windows that can capture now this user experience from home over your VPN, ISP, et cetera, that helps you troubleshoot and detect these end-user issues very quickly and very easily.
So I think the key thing here is that NetBees has actually been in business for about 10 years, and you've been doing network visibility tools and network monitoring tools for that entire time. So you've had some remote working, but what you've done here with this new product is really shifted your focus as your customers needed it. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And there was a big push from the market, obviously. Everybody was faced suddenly with this new reality, ourselves included. We had to start working from home, you know, like from day one to day two. Mm-hmm. And with this new agent now, customers are able to deploy it en masse with all the management tools they have on their end users' machines and capture exactly this information that they couldn't have before, unless they call the user or unless they, you know, like chatted with them.
So let's bring Brad in. Brad, what problems were you trying to solve and what led you to NetBees?
So yeah, ultimately, we were looking for a monitoring solution to work in conjunction with our IWAN deployment to better understand the end user experience at each of our branches and how key services of IWAN, such as performance routing, impact that experience. Additionally, we were looking for readable and valuable data to provide to other teams and our business leaders that we were not able to get with just the IWAN solution alone.
I love the readable data, the valuable data, because if I have this pet theory that if you put a graph in front of an executive, it sort of engages a different part of their brain that actually pays attention. Is that right?
Yeah, that's most definitely right. And coming from the network team and the engineering team, we tend to focus on numbers at a bits and bytes level. But yeah, to them, it's the bottom line that matters.
So this graphical interface, so the first step was you have this IWAN. It's probably running over the public internet as well. And so you have some degree of uncertainty and you needed to be able to get visibility into what was happening there.
That is correct. So ultimately, we use the MVPN tunnels and we locally offload internet traffic at each of our branches. So a lot of our applications, they're impacted by internet backbone. Uh-huh. And as changes occur or brownouts occur to a degree, we're somewhat like visibility into that prior to NetBees. With NetBees, with point-in-time monitoring, such as MyTraceRoute, we can go back in time and match in correlation with what IWAN sees when it comes to thresholds crossing and things of that nature, the IWAN monitoring piece.
When
it makes a change, we can actually correlate that in NetBees and see those changes.
So, and also when the user rings up and says, oh, I've got a problem, you can actually go to NetBees and you can say, oh, yeah, look, the packets are running slow on that branch location where the IWAN is, and then you know it could be the internet in that area, or you know what the next step of troubleshooting is.
Yeah, and in a lot of cases, when they do report problems, they'll call it into the help desk, and then the help desk will tend to escalate up to engineering or whoever that may be, mm-hmm. right? And if IWAN can catch that ahead of time, it will make a path for mediation and try to divert away from that issue. And then a lot of times we can go into NetBees and see that change, or if for whatever reason IWAN doesn't do that, or if a service hangs up and it doesn't do what it's supposed to do when it sees those degradations in services, we can see that in NetBees proactively and go in there and start investigating prior to the user even calling in.
And the unique feature here that you're using, which is not something I've seen everywhere, is you are actually deploying an agent on the iOS routers. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so we're just deploying a KVM image as a container on the ISR routers. So essentially, the router acts as a host for our NetBees agent.
And that's approved by Cisco, supported by Cisco, and it also tells you exactly what the network's doing because the active sensor is actually there in the routing edge.
Yeah, it does two things. It is absolutely supported by Cisco, and with Cisco's DevNet push, these are things that they're trying to kind of get more involved in into the market of, is getting their customers to use these container-based images on the routers. And furthermore, that agent, it actually provides us almost like a remote computer at each branch, because it's just, it runs on Linux, which is really cool too. So we do have a lot of tools within Linux that we can use as pulling DNS information, things of that nature.
So it sort of ties into existing operational skills you've already got.
Correct.
Can I ask how many devices you've rolled this out to so far? How many NetBees monitoring nodes you've got deployed?
Yeah, so we have many branches and we're rolling one agent out per branch. So we have rolled roughly 70 agents out as of today, with about 10 more coming any day now.
Pain threshold? When I say pain threshold, I mean, how hard was it? Was this excruciatingly difficult to get the first one up and running, or was it really just a case of KVM instance, bing, NetBees sensors, ding, done?
No, the process and deployment was extremely straightforward. NetBees provided documentation. The documentation, unlike a lot of documentation, was spot on. It was very accurate and it assisted greatly with the deployment. I know we all laugh in the tech industry because sometimes you get documentation. It says, do it this way, this way, this way. And you get there, it's like, that option's not even available. So I'm not quite sure, where to go from here. Or it requires additional research and additional time.
Right.
But with the NetBees deployment, that was definitely not the case. And once we deployed one or two, we found the process to be extremely repetitive, so we were able to easily automate the process to get these agents deployed in roughly 5 minutes.
I have to say, this is maybe one of the first times I've heard an end user or a customer say, we like the documentation. That's pretty. That's a good.
That's a fresh. Yeah. That's a fresh take.
That's a very fresh take.
So we talked before about some of the things that once you had the NetBees sensors in place, you started seeing things you couldn't sense before. Is there any others that you wanted to cover today?
Some of the things that we were seeing that we weren't seeing before were impacts on changes. And this goes beyond kind of this, just this question, but what we were doing previously was we have multiple tools that kind of help us manage and monitor changes before and after. And many teams across Amwins utilize these tools. But with the NetBees agent, what we're able to do and see was down to the actual response time, down to the path it takes, everything. And it was not only helpful to the network team, but it was helpful to other IT teams within Amwins as well. The DBAs found it extremely useful. Our app teams found it extremely useful. Our infrastructure, our server infrastructure teams found it very useful. Because when they make changes, we were able to go back and look, you know, okay, here was the response times, or this was the standard before the change, and here's where we are now. So how far did we deviate away from that standard? Was it good? Was it bad? So those are some of the things that we were definitely seeing after we deployed NetBees, which was kind of like an added bonus.
So I think that's really probably interesting and critical in that NetBees becomes kind of a common tool that every stack or every silo can take advantage of and get some benefit from.
Most definitely, because I think from any IT department, one of the things that we tend to overlook is how our changes impact the end user experience, and be able to go back and monitor that data and see that data, and not only to take that data and provide it to business leaders and say, hey, look, the changes we're making are actually helping our infrastructure, our network, our, you know, it makes us all look good. So
it turns you into the truth police, because when the DBA says, I've done something to fix the performance, you can hold it up and go like, no, it isn't.
It's funny you mentioned that, because we actually had an issue similar to that.
Yeah.
shortly after our proof of concept of the product, our change went on the weekend, and we seen, I think, about 20 milliseconds increase in response times. And it was like, that seems very minute, but, you know, what did you guys do? And they went back and had a, ultimately, I don't know what was done to resolve on the DBA side, but they did revert some of those changes.
I mean, the other part of this is that it's sort of keeping all the groups honest in that they can't just say it's the network, because everyone's using this tool and has sort of a common grammar to speak to each other with, that you can't just say, we the DBAs know it's not our fault because it's the network, when you can all look at the tool again and be like, nope.
Well, and that's probably my favorite thing about this is, and I don't know if every organization I've ever worked for, that seems to be the commonality is, it's the network. And I feel like, you know, many network teams have to go out of their way to prove that, no, it's not the network, but here you go. This is probably where you should start looking, kind of thing. You know, to have that information readily available is definitely beneficial.
So we talked about using NetBees in the context of your IWAN deployment. What about software as a service or cloud apps? Are you able to leverage NetBees there in any way?
Yeah, what I did was I worked with our Microsoft team in-house. And what they were able to do was give us some URLs to some of our more common Microsoft services, such as our Office 365 suite. And we're using it to monitor, you know, HTTP response times to like SharePoint sites. We're using it to monitor DNS to make sure that URLs are actually resolving correctly. We even have it, you know, tracking like a MyTrace route going out and watching from each branch to see how, you know, if we're using Outlook or Office 365, we want to know how the internet is actually impacting that service, especially with voice, Microsoft Teams, things like that, that seem to be a little more susceptible to issues and packet loss and jitter. You know, to be able to see that, get alerts on that when something crosses a threshold that we've set within the NetBees dashboard, it just makes for an overall better experience.
So let's shift back to Panos. Panos, you touched earlier on the remote working, and we talked about the fact that it's a transition from your existing product. It's not a ground up sort of thing. What sort of customers do you have today that are using it for supporting distributed work?
Yes, so we see lots of interest from the financial services and healthcare industry. And it's interesting what we found out. The reality is that, you know, if it's you, Greg, or Brad that is having issue with their Wi-Fi or network, most likely you can figure it out, right? And figure it out yourselves. But we see, of course, you have all these unskilled employees that they don't need to be skilled to all the Wi-Fi details and networks, right? And that's where the sweet spot is, I think, where you need to support these people that don't have the technical knowledge to even give you feedback of what's going on, right? And lots of people in sales, support, in financial services and healthcare have this kind of need, and we see lots of, you know, like interest from that sector of the market.
I think it's really interesting that we talked to Bradley about the idea of the remote sensor being deployed inside the Cisco ISR router here, but it's fundamentally the same principle when you install it on someone's PC or their MacBook, right? It's the same idea.
Yeah, definitely. If you look at the dashboard, actually, it's very uniform. You can have the same type, you know, like the same type of test you have on the ISR routers and the same type of test running on the end user's laptop. And that's actually, I think, a very powerful visibility feature we have, where you can compare easily data from different sources, right? So you can see from, you know, over the VPN what's going on. You can see what's going on from your concentrator to the internet. You have split tunnel or not, you can very easily compare data and see where the discrepancies are and where the bottleneck might be.
So I think we've probably run out of time. Panos, if folks want to find out more about NetBees or get in touch with them, where should they go?
Definitely, yeah. You can find us, of course, at netbees.net. We're very active on our blog, netbees.net/blog. We're running a series of Linux for Network Engineers posts there. So if you're getting into DevNet that Brad talked about and you're looking into Linux right now, you can have lots of good material over there. And at NetBees on Twitter, also, you are very active on the community there.
All right, so that's netbees.net, and that's NetBees with a Z, B-E-E-Z, not an S, netbees.net. Panos and Brad, thank you for joining us, and thanks to NetBees for being a sponsor. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog. That's at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.